This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, January 1st, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown, and Happy New Year. How has campaign finance changed since the famous or infamous Citizens United decision that freed up some spending in elections? And how do voter attitudes drive legislative efforts to restrict spending in elections? David Primo and Jeff Milo are authors of Campaign Finance and American Democracy: What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. We spoke late last year. Careful listeners to the Cato Daily Podcast will note that I never fail to point out when we're talking about campaign finance issues is that the public, or at least people who talk about Citizens United, almost, including the news media, who really should be more attuned to what the implications of that case are for them, fundamentally do not understand what that case was about and what the Supreme Court said. So just using that as an example, what do we know about what the public thinks about campaign finance issues?
So I'll take that one. You know, both Dave Primo and I have studied money and politics for many years, and it's fair to say that the general public has this conventional wisdom that there's too much money in politics, that elective offices are essentially for sale to the highest bidder, that campaign contributions are the functional equivalent of bribes, that all of this alienates the public, results in declining trust, and leads to corruption in politics, and as a result, that there's a great need for campaign finance reform to preserve the integrity of democracy. And in addition to just asserting that that's a conventional wisdom, in our book, we conduct a survey of the general public, and sure enough, these kinds of propositions, people agree. In fact, the level of agreement is on the order of 89% or more agree that, for example, elections are essentially for sale to the highest bidder, to the biggest spender. And if anyone's familiar with survey research, if you were to ask people, are you taking a survey, you probably wouldn't get 89% agreeing. So it's really quite a very strongly held conventional wisdom among the public.
And there are a whole host of politicians who are very happy to reinforce that view.
It's not just politicians. We also have reform groups that are sustained by this belief that money is a corrupting force in American politics. The news media, which reports about campaign finance in a very particular way, emphasizing the extremes of campaign finance, and quite often just asserting without evidence that, for instance, if a politician receives money from an interest group, therefore that money has somehow influenced how that politician is behaving.
That is a dominant view among members of the public. What did you dig into to find out whether or not that's true?
So I'll go with the second conventional wisdom that we identify is that among those of us who actually study the role of money in American politics, there's a very different view. And this comes from decades of social science research looking at the efficacy of campaign spending on electoral outcomes, on the efficacy of campaign contributions and lobbying, on the outcomes of the policy process. And, you know, we could talk at length about those studies. And often there's this core of true believers who just don't want to believe the science. And I almost get enjoyment out of believing American politics is very corrupt. So we hit upon the idea of rather than us just being the messengers and people dismissing it as maybe these idiosyncratic cranks with this bizarre take on the science, we did a survey of experts who study money and politics and conduct peer-reviewed scientific studies. And that survey basically reveals just about the opposite on most of those conventional wisdoms, that campaign spending is not that effective, especially at the margin among competitive candidates, that campaign contributions and lobbying are not the functional equivalent of bribes, and that campaign spending doesn't result in declining trust in government. The group tends to be favorable of reform nonetheless, because academics do tend to be a very liberal activist and progressive group. But there are two conventional wisdoms about money and politics. There's the scientific consensus, and then there's that fearful public consensus.
You know, when you look at what the experts think, I was really surprised by the fact that there was this belief among experts based on the scientific evidence that money is not corrupting, that campaign contributions are not the functional equivalent of bribes, as Jeff said. Yet the academics by and large support campaign finance reform. And for me, at least, that result brought to light just how much of a deep-seated belief there is in the evils of money, that even evidence to the contrary about money's nefarious force in the process isn't going to change people's, even experts' belief systems about just how important reform is. It's this amorphous need to fix democracy.
When people say that they support campaign finance reform, I'm trying to thread the needle here between what the public believes and what experts believe. Is it just that they don't want the appearance of the potential corrupting influence of money, even if your research indicates that that's not a strong a claim that occurs?
Well, the public is of two minds here. You know, when you ask whether they think campaign finance reform is necessary to restore the integrity of American democracy, they say, yes, absolutely, 100%. Let's go for it. But when you ask the question a slightly different way, when you ask members of the public, do you think that campaign finance reforms are actually going to have any effect on how politics operates, you get very, very different results, much more skepticism about whether or not reforms can actually be effective. So again, that goes back to my point about this, there being this deep-seated belief that somehow campaign finance reform is going to be a magic elixir. But when you actually force people to say, is this actually going to fix anything? Then you get a lot more pushback, which to me at least reveals a deep-seated cynicism among the American public that runs far deeper than money. That money is just a convenient bogeyman. It's a bogeyman. It's a very convenient target for the efforts of reformers, and the public has largely bought into that narrative. But the public's more pragmatic at the end of the day, and they realize, you know, this isn't going to fix what's wrong with politics.
Jeff?
And just to add to that point, once we start talking about corruption and the public's views of corruption, we need to answer the question, what is corruption? And the Supreme Court, or at least the majority on the Supreme Court, has been fairly clear and consistent that what we mean by corruption is essentially bribery and influence peddling, quid pro quo exchanges of money for political favors, and not sort of normal everyday politics where politicians try to win the favor of various interest groups by making pleasing sounding arguments and the like. And so when you look at public opinion that says, well, people think money in politics is corrupt, or you give them a scenario and they say, ah, that's corrupt, it turns out that the general public thinks almost everything politicians do is corrupt, whether it's trying to get favorable media coverage, whether it's log rolling or vote trading, whether it's pressure from party leaders. Even if you present an innocent scenario where a legislator votes against the preferences of his constituents because of a belief that it's the best thing for the country, you still get about a quarter respondent saying that's corrupt too. There's just, you know, nothing politicians can do that people don't think is pretty suspicious and corrupt. And all the more so, and we go on at length with some evidence on this, but it's not too surprising. All the more so, if I'm a Democrat, I view anything Republicans do as corrupt. And if I'm a Republican, anything the Democrats do is viewed as corrupt. So there's a deep suspicion, but then there's also this deep partisanship, this partisan lens through which people view politics and call basically anyone who disagrees with them, they call that corrupt.
One claim that I have heard, and it's the only place I've heard it, Lawrence Lessig used to make the claim that, he speaks often in ways that indicate that he's the first person to look at a lot of this stuff. But he made the claim that, look, the relevant point at which this influence occurs is not during a campaign, that it's before the campaign even starts, that money is either promised or is in escrow, in a sense, until somebody decides to run or not run. And that's where the big sort occurs when it comes to candidates for political office.
You know, Larry Lessig has a very an expansive definition of corruption. It's not in some senses not unlike the expansive definition of corruption that the American public has, and it's almost sort of an ethereal theory of corruption where corruption just suffuses Washington and it suffuses state legislatures. It's just everywhere. It's in the air. And so you just can't help but being corrupt by virtue of being in Washington. And what's difficult for me and for social scientists to deal with a theory like that is it's very hard to actually understand that in any empirical sense. To just say that the whole thing is corrupt, right? Well, I don't know that the term corruption really has much meaning at that point. And so I don't quite know what to do with Larry Lessig's theories, in that they just seem to be so all-encompassing in terms of their beliefs about what's corrupt, that there isn't really a lot you can get a handle on from a scientific perspective.
And so there are two issues with this, what we might call miasma theory of corruption, that it's just in the air. One is that, as Dave said, it's hard to get a handle on it, but then you know, we can go to the evidence and we could say, you know, has the miasma cleared up if we adopt campaign finance reform? We can test those kinds of hypotheses. But I have to put on my professor hat and gown here for a moment and say, you know, Lessig is an extreme example, and many campaign finance reformers are, of what we might call a literally romantic notion of democracy, that there's a general will, and the purpose of democratic institutions is to implement this general will. And it's sort of taken as given that everyday politics and vote trading and party pressure and money in politics is somehow distorting this otherwise pure implementation of the general will. And, you know, again, decades of social science research would tell us that collectives don't have an individual will like that. There's no such thing as the general will. And so once you understand democracy as a process by which collective decisions are arrived at, and that campaign spending, lobbying, you know, appeals to the public are all the engine of democracy, and that they require resources and coordination and political entrepreneurs, then you see this more dynamic process that isn't so nefarious. But Lessig and others have this notion that people are well-formed, fully informed citizens, knowledgeable about all issues, and we just need to count noses and implement what the general will is, as if people come into this world like Athena, fully armored from Zeus's head, instead of being rationally ignorant and arguments having to be made and interests having to be coordinated and a more active, dynamic view of democracy.
Yeah, when you present this idea that if the public may believe that offices are for sale to the highest bidder, that definitely leaves one group out of the process of achieving high office, and that is voters. If you look at the Bloomberg for President campaign, how much did he spend? For almost nothing.
If I can build on Jeff's point a little bit, sort of, and the Bloomberg point I think ties in nicely with this, is again, there's this belief out there that somehow if we can get campaign finance reform, we'll get the right outcomes, right? And so, and I think Bloomberg would largely believe, you know, if we can just spend a lot of money, sort of the opposite of you, we can get the right outcomes. But what are the right outcomes? Well, I encourage the audience to look carefully when reformers call for campaign finance reform or politicians call for campaign finance reform, they often will identify specific policy outcomes that, when achieved, would prove to be evidence of how successful reform was. In other words, we need campaign finance reform so that we can have climate change legislation that that eliminates oil and gas, so that we can have universal healthcare. And then they list a set of policy proposals that many people would agree with, but many people would disagree with, but assert that that would, of course, be the will of the people if we just got rid of money in politics. And
these are the baseline views, the uncorrupted views of Americans.
Correct.
Well, when we look at the evidence here, you guys draw a pretty bright line between before Citizens United and after Citizens United at a couple of different spots in your book, at least. What do we know about the rate of incumbency for politicians pre and post Citizens United? And does that tell us anything with confidence?
Well, I'll grab that one. In general, political scientists and political economists have studied the relationship between campaign finance laws and competitiveness of elections. And not part of the book, but a recent study I had that just came out this summer does that at the level of the states, where we can use the states as laboratories, because there are very different campaign finance regulations across the states. They change over time. And the bottom line is that campaign finance reform does not make elections for state legislature more competitive, and in particular, independent expenditures. Some states had prohibited independent expenditures prior to Citizens United. Now they can't. And if we look at that, what we actually see is an increase in competitiveness and more turnover of incumbents. So at least at the state level, you see that. But I don't think there's any credible argument that politics has become less competitive since 2010. If anything, it appears very much just the opposite.
Yeah, one of the things that when I talk to people who don't follow this stuff very closely, and I don't follow it nearly as closely as you guys do, and this was something I learned from a practitioner of politics years ago, which is an incumbent politician, low name ID in his district may well be an asset to his campaign. And that is an opponent, an upstart opponent who would like to challenge them, raising their opponent's name ID to sort of shape them in the public's eye as a bad guy is an asset to their campaign.
Well, one of the, if you think about Citizens United and its effect on campaigns, the claims that were made after Citizens United about what would happen to American democracy, I really wish that those who made those claims were being held to account a little bit more. Claims that democracy was going to be destroyed, claims that corporations are going to take over the political process, that elections were essentially, just artificial enterprises at this point, because the outcomes were predetermined, were going to be predetermined by the money. That trust in government would plummet. None of this has come to pass. None of it has come to pass. And yet that decision, sort of like the belief in campaign finance reform, has itself taken on a mythical status. Citizens United is no longer really just a Supreme Court decision. It is a call to arms. Right. It is a call for campaign finance reform, for changes to the system, and so on.
I remember one hyperbolic commentator referring to Citizens United as the Dred Scott decision of our time, and even then, that struck me as ludicrous.
The sense of proportionality or lack of proportionality was stunning in that comment. Yes.
So with respect to competitive elections, there are all these anecdotes you can pluck out of the air and say, well, this happened in this race and this proves X. And of course, that's not what you guys are doing in your book. You're taking a far more systematic approach. But did any of your thoughts get updated by what happened in 2016, 2018, and 2020? That is, Donald Trump was heavily outspent in 2016 and cobbled together enough electoral votes to win the White House.
Yeah, no, I would say, we've been like John the Baptist all along, and more people are coming to realize you know, from anecdotes like that, what the science has been saying all along. And so that episode was very helpful in that regard, and Bloomberg's campaign as well, you know, that clearly to win votes, you need more than just advertising. You need content, you need ideas, you need to be credible to the public that you're going to be a good representative, and all the money in the world, or pretty close to it, isn't going to get you many delegates in the Democratic primary, despite what some, you know, demagogues have to say about it.
The way I think about it is, you know, that you need a certain amount of money to run a viable presidential campaign. There's no doubt about that. But fundamentally, if you don't have a product that's going to sell, quote unquote, then the amount of money in your ad budget isn't going to make a difference. And we can look at products in American society, major flops of products that had billions or millions of dollars behind them, but none of the marketing worked because the products were fundamentally bad products. And so if you don't have a great candidate, the amount of money you spend just isn't going to be enough to push you over the edge to win in many cases.
And just to jump on that point and extend it, I mean, this is what economists would call diminishing marginal productivity. So let's be clear, if I were to run for office and not spend much money, I wouldn't get a very high percent of the vote. And if I spent a lot of money, I might double my share of the vote from 2% to 4%. But that's not going to win elective office. And so when you're talking about contested elections with candidates that have been endorsed by parties and have the resources of the parties behind them, the marginal productivity of campaign spending is very, very low. And so that reverberates. That means that when a candidate gets a contribution from a political action committee of, say, $5,000, or even an independent expenditure in a contested Senate race from a super PAC that might run $1 million, that the candidate's not going to be very grateful for those expenditures because they really don't have much of an impact at the margin on the electoral prospects of the candidate. And so that feeds back to this issue of, well, just how influential are campaign contributions or super PAC expenditures? And most of the evidence would say not very influential, and that's part of the reason why.
Now, we should clarify a little bit. Contributions from PACs to campaigns are under the control of the campaign. Independent expenditures by law cannot be under the control or direction or coordination of the campaign. Those are expenditures that are made based upon very likely a completely separate reading of polls and what the public is going to respond to and what voters might be interested in order to get X candidate into office. So you made this sort of reference to the marginal productivity of independent expenditures, Jeff, and why don't donors know this, or why are donors not responsive to this? I mean, money pours into super PACs in an attempt to influence elections. One would think that these donors, who presumably have a lot of money in order to give it, should be smarter about where their money goes if they want to influence public policy.
Well, maybe after they read our book, they will be smarter. But you know, we don't have to assume that everybody knows everything. But I think the better understanding of, you know, people who get involved in politics, are they doing it because they're trying to bribe politicians and corruptly influence policy? No, they're doing it because they're sincere, they're patriots, they want to be, you know, in the game, on the team, whether it's the blue team or the red team, and they sincerely support those positions. They're giving their time, their resources. And these are all, I think, admirable things and all necessary for a well-functioning democracy. So donors are giving not because they're trying to buy policy, but they're trying to support like-minded candidates, a like-minded party, and to bring about, in their mind, better public policy. And so it's not so surprising that that people with a lot of discretionary income or wealth get some utility out of those kinds of activities.
And another way to think about it is that, you know, there are some forms of campaign spending may be more effective than other forms of campaign spending, but those who run campaigns often are paid based on how much they spend. So in other words, if you do an ad buy, if you're a campaign manager, you're a consultant, you do an ad buy, you get a cut of the, you know, get a percentage of the ad buy. So what does that do? That creates incentives to structure campaigns in a way that may actually not be particularly efficient. So that's one reason we might see this paradox. Another reason is that even if at the margin campaign spending doesn't have much of an effect, you don't quite know, you know, there might be this competitive aspect where campaigns are going to keep spending money until they get to that point where the money isn't having much of an effect. So at the margin, it's not having any effect, but if they spent nothing at all, well, then their candidate wouldn't do very well. And so there's this competitive effect as well. But you know, there's a literature in advertising that shows that a lot of advertising for products doesn't really have that much of an effect, yet companies still have ad budgets. So there's old habits sometimes die hard.
And it's worth emphasizing that, you know, when you're spending other people's money, there's a lot of room for waste, fraud, and abuse, and for people to take a cut of the pie. And so that happens in government spending in general. It happens in political campaigns. And so definitely some of that is happening. When you see an individual putting up their own money like Bloomberg, that's more like, you know, a fool and his money. So those are the kind of candidates that we could educate.
The big pitch here is that if you are part of the moneyed donor class in politics, take a small portion of what you would be giving in 2022, buy this book, and potentially save yourself many thousands of dollars in super PAC contributions and campaign contributions. Is that basically the pitch?
Well, I go back to what Jeff said, is that, you know, it depends on why you're involved in politics. Maybe, for instance, you create a super PAC because you want to make sure that a candidate's message gets out there so that people are aware that this candidate has these views or represents a set of views that isn't represented well in American politics. So you know, we've all been beating on Michael Bloomberg here a little bit, but what Michael Bloomberg, you know, perhaps was trying to do is say, look, if I run for office, he may know he's gonna lose, but he's hoping that perhaps the issues that are important to him will now get some attention in ways they wouldn't otherwise. You think about that as the Ross Perot effect, perhaps, and that can have an impact. So, you know, in some sense, focusing on the efficacy of campaign spending almost, you know, plays into the narrative that the only reason why people could possibly contribute to campaigns is because they want to influence the process or influence outcomes directly. Whereas there could be lots of different reasons why you might contribute to a campaign.
And we've been beating on reformers as well, but let's throw them a bone here. I think there is something of an awakening in the campaign finance reform movement where there's a little less emphasis on demonizing money in politics. I mean, that's still done, of course, but more toward trying to encourage more people to contribute and to encourage small donations, encourage more ordinary citizens to vote. And if we go back to that idea of diminishing marginal productivity, how do you get sort of the big donors and the big donations to be less influential? You don't restrict total spending. You want to encourage more uninterested money to flow into campaigns, if you will. And so the more ordinary citizens participate and are active and make contributions, the less influential a few money bags are going to be.
David Primo and Jeff Milo are authors of Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.